We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this hour of the program, we'll be talking a little bit about Japan and Japanese history. And our guest for the show is Harvard historian David Howell. He is one of the country's leading authorities on 19th century Japan. And he's interested in this period of Japanese history where the country was preparing to move from isolation to globalization. One of the things that we want to try to look at this morning as we talk is maybe a little bit about how Japanese people have thought about themselves and their country over time, but particularly also to look at how it is they thought about issues of resources, natural resource management, and how you deal with the issues, that comes with large concentrations of people. Because also at this time, Japan had some of the world's biggest cities. He's here visiting the campus and will be giving a talk this afternoon on a subject that some people might find unpleasant, but it's something, again, it's very important when you have big concentrations of people, and that's how do you deal with all of the waste that those people produce? He'll be giving a talk on this afternoon at 3:30 on the campus in room 223 of Gregory Hall. So if people are interested, they can stop by. We'll talk a little bit about it in this hour, and then maybe try to get at some of these larger issues that have to do with resource management, what we can learn today by looking at how people dealt with these things in the past. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point, you can call in if you have a question. You can also go online and send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
As a way of starting, I think that it is the period of history, of Japanese history, that you're interested in, I think, is a particularly interesting one.
Yes.
Because it's a very transitional period when Japan went from being a closed feudal society to very rapidly becoming a modern industrialized country that stood toe-to-toe with the industrialized countries of Europe.
Yes. That's always been the thing that fascinated me about Japanese history, especially the transformation of the 19th century. How quickly and how relatively painlessly, there was pain along the way, but relatively painlessly and successfully, Japan underwent this incredible transformation over the course of the 19th century.
Yeah. Just maybe, is there some particular thing that you can point to that would be something that would make that a little more concrete?
Yeah, I think in the context of East Asian history, in China, the decline and fall of the Qing Empire was very long and protracted, so that when a baby born in the year of the Opium War in 1839, that person could have died of old age by the time the regime finally fell in 1911. In Japan, in contrast, although it had been relatively more isolated from the Western world in the first half of the 19th century, was faced with the challenge of Western imperialism led by the United States, but also Russia and Britain and France and so on. Mm-hmm. And somehow a group of relatively young, relatively inexperienced men were able to engineer first the downfall of the Tokugawa shogunate and then install, in the name of restoring the emperor, which is kind of a call to the past, they were able to install a westward-looking eagerly modernizing regime in a way that they were able to contain the many differences that they had among themselves, sell their ideas, so to speak, to the Japanese people, quash resistance when it did occur, and there was resistance, and somehow keep the imperialist wolves at bay all at the same time. And it's I don't think we have enough time to try to sort out all the reasons, but it's certainly unprecedented in world history.
Yeah. So it just for non-Japanese history buffs, we're talking about two periods here, one that's named after the man who unified Japan in the early 1600s, a man named Tokugawa.
Right.
His descendants, or at least people who had his name, ruled the country for around 250 years
yes.
until Matthew Perry sailed in with his gunboats in 1868, forcing the opening of the country. And then we have this period called the Meiji period, which is named for the emperor.
Yes.
Meiji emperor.
Yes.
And so there was about another, how long was Meiji period?
From 1868 to 1912.
Okay. So that's what we're talking about. And it's a very, very interesting and very important turning point in Japanese history. So going to the resource question, mm-hmm. I think that a lot of people have looked at this very rapid period of modernization.
Yes.
And they have asked this question, well, what was it about Japan and Japanese society that actually made that possible for them to make that turn like mm-hmm. that? And I think that maybe some people have actually pointed to the issue of public health
yes.
as being a key factor.
Yes. I think there are a number of things that I could point out. One, starting with the most sort of fortuitous, is that Japan is an archipelago, and therefore it remained somewhat isolated from a lot of the epidemic diseases and whatnot that devastated other parts of the world. And so when diseases like cholera came in to Japan in, I think the first epidemic was in 1858, not coincidentally, just a few years after Perry, the authorities could literally see the epidemic coming before it arrived and then try to take steps to ameliorate the problems. There were still lots of deaths and whatnot. But in a sense, by being an island country, Japan was geographically protected from some of the onslaughts of whether it's bacteria or viruses or of imperialism. And then also I think that historically things like a good example is forestry management, which doesn't sound like a sexy topic, but a colleague of mine, Conrad Topman, wrote this wonderful book called The Green Archipelago. I think it came out in the late 80s, in which he asked the question, why is Japan such a green country? If you go to Japan, although it's very densely populated, 130 or 140 million people, there are trees everywhere. The mountains are all heavily forested. And he says that Japan ought to look like Haiti, where the forests have been denuded and it's a kind of ecological wasteland in many ways, given that there's so many people on so little land. And he points to the policies of the Tokugawa shogunate and other feudal authorities during the Tokugawa period, who very cleverly managed to promote afforestation, that is when trees were cut down. They promoted the replanting of trees. They worked out deals with local peasants who would go in and harvest brush for and green manure and things like that for fertilizer without leaving the old stands of trees standing. So that, in a way, a kind of government and civil partnership, though people weren't really thinking of it in those terms, emerged to protect the resources of the forest, which then in turn helped to prevent erosion on agricultural land, it kept agricultural productivity high, and helped to make the country wealthy, relatively speaking, in the years running up to the collapse of the Tokugawa regime in 1868.
Mm-hmm. Living on an island, I think, it leads people to develop rarely interesting kind of psychologies. And at least there is this bottom line that says, anything you need, if you can't make it yourself, you're going to have to get it from someplace else and you're going to have to bring it there.
Yes.
And I think what's particularly, again, interesting about Japan and this time that we're talking about is that during the time the country was essentially closed, like 250 years, they had to be resource self-sufficient.
Yes.
And that that I think now today people in Japan are looking back at that time and they're asking this question, are there some things that we could possibly learn by looking at how resources were managed at that time?
Yes. In fact, there's a lively discussion of this in Japan. If you go to any big bookstore, there's a kind of ECO section of books. Okay. And there are a number of people writing precisely about this. What can we learn from the Tokugawa period as we face this sort of increasingly fragile world in the future? And I think certainly one of the things that people point out is that the material culture of the country, on the one hand, used a lot of wood and things that don't necessarily last a long time, But also people were very smart about the way they used resources. So they tried to make the most out of the wood or other products that they did harvest. And they came up with clever ways of sort of workarounds to find ways to make do with the resources at hand. So, for example, the water supply of the city of Edo, which is now Tokyo, it's a city that had more than a million people by the early 18th century, had this really, really complex and intricate system of aqueducts that was all based on bamboo, which grows rapidly, is easily replaced. So rather than having metal pipes, they had bamboo pipes, and that supplied the water for the city.
Our guest in this hour of focus is David Howell. He's professor of Japanese history at Harvard. He's visiting the campus to give a talk this afternoon and is talking with us here about the time in Japanese history he's interested in and early modern Japan, and also about this issue of how it is that the Japanese at that time dealt with particular problems that come with having large concentrations of people. And he will be talking about one of them this afternoon, and I will go on and we'll talk a little bit of that as well. That is the problem of human waste. Questions are welcome, though, too, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Japan, one of the things that, again, people maybe might not realize that at the times that we're talking about, Japan was a highly urbanized country.
Yes.
And that it had some of, around at 1700, it had some of the world's biggest cities.
Yes.
So when you get that many people together, you got some big issues. You got to feed them, and then you have to deal with their waste.
Yes. Yes. As I mentioned earlier, Edo, which is now Tokyo, had something over a million people by 1720. There were other significant cities as well. Kyoto and Osaka each had about 400,000, and there were several others that had about 100,000 people. Overall, out of the population of about 30 million during the time, maybe a tenth, 3 million people, lived in major cities.
Mm-hmm. And the thing that's really, I think, fascinating about this whole waste thing is that they managed to develop a quite an ingenious system to deal with it that not only got rid of the waste in a way that was safe, so you don't have the disease issues associated with your wood, but that it actually made it into a valuable commodity. People actually fought,
yes,
over it and to have access to it.
Yes, that's correct. From very early in Japanese history, human waste or night soil was seen as a particularly efficacious fertilizer, and so it was widely known and widely used. And so from the earliest sources that I've seen in the late 17th century, agricultural manuals give instructions on how best to utilize human waste and how to use it on different kinds of crops. And so over the course of the Tokugawa period in big cities, especially Edo and Osaka, really complex distribution networks emerged, and there were lots of different varieties. But basically, owners of apartment buildings or samurai living in their mansions would contract with peasants or with brokers who would then come periodically to collect the contents of the latrines and then transport them out into the countryside for use, for processing and then eventual use as fertilizer. And yes, over the course of the 18th century in particular, demand really increased as commercial farming grew in the area around Edo. And there were huge fights. In 1789, a kind of nice year, I guess, for conflict, 1,000 villages in the hinterland of Edo rose up in protest and demanded that the authorities of the Tokugawa shogunate intervene in the night soil market because the price had risen so much that they couldn't afford this valuable fertilizer. Mm-hmm. And they wanted the government to eliminate the middlemen, these brokers who would buy up the contents of thousands and thousands and thousands of privies.
Yeah. And primarily because human waste can be a disease vector,
yes,
they had a way to, I guess they composted it, essentially. They had a way to deal with it so that they could deal with that problem and then get something that actually could be safely used.
Yes. in these agricultural manuals, there are instructions on how to build composting bins. And typically what would happen is the night soil collectors would collect the raw contents of privies, transport them by boat up river to the hinterland, where it would be offloaded and then distributed to farms. And the farms would each have their own composting area. And they would leave the material out there for anywhere from a few months to about a year. And in the course of that time, the harmful bacteria would die off, the smell would disappear, and in the end, they would have this very rich organic fertilizer. And they would mix other, like, household waste and plant waste and things like that in with it as well.
Yeah. And you talked about the system that was organized to collect it. That I guess it's my understanding that if you indeed had some sort of a large build, you had an inn or an apartment building or something like that where you had people living, you own that building, their waste, their solid waste, was yours.
Yes. Yes.
And it was your property.
Yes. And in fact, it said that for many apartment buildings, it was the contents of the latrines that was the main income source, rather than the rent that the tenants paid.
Yeah, it's really remarkable that they managed to take this thing that is unpleasant, is harmful. It's the thing that you want to get rid of and you don't want to think about it, and turn it into an extremely valuable commodity. Yes. With these very complex markets.
Yes, it is. It's quite amazing. And it's not as though in Western Europe people didn't know about night soil. It was used as a fertilizer in Europe as well. And at about the same time in the 18th century in Germany and in France, even in the United States, there are people talking about how, you know, we really ought to start thinking about how we can use this waste because it is such a potent fertilizer. But there was always a kind of, I don't know what to call it, like a desperate tone to the discourse that there was frustration among a few scientists or agronomists who were worried that people were throwing away this valuable stuff and messing up the Seine and the Thames rivers and so on. Whereas in Japan, they never had to persuade people to use night soil, and the market and the distribution networks actually sort of emerged on their own, organically, so to speak, over the course of the 17th and into the 18th century.
So what do you think accounts for the difference in the two mindsets?
Well, I think one simple reason is that in much of Europe, there were lots of people had lots of livestock, so that cows and horses would provide fertilizer for farmers. Whereas in Japan, there wasn't quite as much pastoralism. Yet farmers in Japan also had oxen and horses, and they used the manure that those animals produced as well. So I think, although that's the usual reason that European farmers had cows and Japanese did not, I think that's probably a little bit too simple. And I think that it's more about a realization, well, first a sense that human waste was more potent than animal waste, so it was a better fertilizer, and the proximity of farming villages to the city, I think, also helped, and ready transportation networks and rivers and things. Mm-hmm. So there are practical reasons, but also I think the idea that human waste was the best of all helped to inform the development of the system.
Yeah. Well, here, this connecting this then to maybe again going back to this question about how it is that Japan was able to so rapidly modernize, I think that there are some people have really made this argument that said one of the things that you really need to look at is the all of the markers of physical well-being of people. And that so one of the things that you really want to be able to provide if your population is going to be healthy, well, you've got to have clean water.
Yes.
And you've got to have one way to a way of safely disposing of waste. There's at least two things that you really need to have. And they seem to have this down pretty
yes.
well. And that in other ways as well, if you look at the physical well-being of the Japanese people at, you know, say in 1800, or even earlier, say in 1700, and compare that to the physical well-being of people, say, living in Germany or France or Britain, it's really strikingly high. And in many ways, I think you'd say they would have to be better, have to have been better off, the Japanese, and that somehow that contributed to their ability to really take off in the late 19th century.
Yes. Well, I tell my students that if you had to go back to live someplace in the age before antibiotics, going back to Tokugawa Japan would be a pretty good choice because the cities were so much more hygienic. And I think you know, there were lots of other things that contributed to the stability of Japanese society and the growth of the economy. You had a relatively healthy, relatively well-educated population. Communications were good, and so on. But I think if people are bent over sick all the time, no matter how well-educated they are, they can't modernize anything. They've got other things to worry about.
Yeah. Yeah. We're around midway through this conversation, and we're talking with David Howell. He's professor of Japanese history at Harvard University. He's visiting the campus, and he will be talking about this very subject, about how it is in Japan in the Tokugawa and the Meiji period, so roughly about a 300-year period. They dealt with human waste in really ingenious sorts of ways. He'll be talking this afternoon at 3:30 in the room 223 of Gregory Hall on the campus. Anybody who's interested in attending should certainly feel welcome. We won't take a minute here to talk about I'll see if I can avoid any sort of fertilizer-related jokes here about public broadcasting. But the fact of the matter is that we're trying to maintain a rich and healthy public broadcasting system here, and a great source of energy and support and strength are listeners, particularly the listeners who support the station with their money. And that's what we're asking for right now. Jack Brighton is here in the studio with me. He's the man we call the producer emeritus.
Yes.
Of Focus, because he was our producer for such a long time. And now he is the guy who oversees all of the various and sundry things we do on the web now. And he's here to join me in urging people to make a call or go online and make a pledge.
Absolutely. And, you know, this show has been on the air for 30 years now. And it's really a source of great comfort to me to know that for 30 years we've been talking about international affairs. We've been talking about health, all kinds of the economy, politics, the how-tos of life. And those are the kinds of shows that this community has said they want to keep us doing that. So you can help make a little contribution right now by making your pledge at 217-244-9455. Or you can go online to willpledge.org and just take care of it right quick right there. I just, want to say something about sort of the institution of Focus 580. Do you know that, David, it's an institution now? How about that?
I'm not even sure how one defines that. How do you mean that institution?
I don't know. I guess I'm just thinking 30 years, pretty much qualifies.
Well, I'd say so. Okay. Yes, I think so. I think we've fairly well established.
That's right.
In the minds of people. And it's just sort of, I'm actually a little stunned about it when I think about it, having been involved in the program almost all that time.
Yeah.
And all of the conversations we've had, all of the people who have been here on this show, I've learned an awful lot of things. I hope people have who've listened, and at least people have told me that.
Yeah.
And I think having somebody like Professor Howell here shows the kind of thing that we've done. We try to highlight work of scholars on our campus and from other places, because they have all sorts of interesting things to say. And I hope that also we do it in a way that will be, you don't have to be a Japanese historian to listen to this conversation and say, oh, well, that's pretty interesting. I got that. We're trying to open it up to as many people as possible. And I have always liked to think that actually is, it's kind of like what the university is supposed to be.
That's right.
I think.
That's right. And I was thinking about last week I was actually in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I was on the campus of Harvard, and I was actually at the Cambridge Public Library, which is the oldest public library in the United States. It's a wonderful place. There's an old historic section, there's a new section, and it's really just a marvelous public space. And, that got me thinking, well, there are a lot of parallels, actually. I think we're very much, very much like public libraries in the sense of being public spaces, public institutions that communities rely upon and use, and, they're trusted neutral grounds for discussion of things. And I think that's what this show, to me, and you're very kind to continue to call me producer emeritus, because that's a title I hold very dear. I think the proudest period of my work here has been on the show. So I just want to say that those of you listening, please, your part is really important to keep the show going, to keep us, having these discussions, and to keep the operation of WILL able to produce shows like Focus 580. So your contribution right now at 217 844-944-9455 really helps. Or you can go online to willpledge.org.
All right. Well, thanks. Well, and I do, before we get back to our conversation here, I just do want to acknowledge the work of the producers, and I have had a number of them over the years, Harriet Williamson now, and Jack Brighton, and Travis Stansel, and Jeannie Taylor, who used to be Jeannie Cheeseman, and a number of people who have done that. And
Mary Ellen Page. I
couldn't do the show without the producers. They are very, very important. So their contribution is huge. Martha Deal, indeed. So we hope that if you like the show, if you've gotten a few things out of it over the years, if you're not a supporter of the station, and that means you'll not only be just supporting this show, but everything that we do on WILL, I'd like to hear from you. I'd appreciate it. You could call us 217-244-9455, make a pledge, or go online, willpledge.org. We want to continue our conversation with David Howell. He's professor of Japanese history at Harvard. He grew up in Hawaii, went to university in Hawaii, also studied at Hokkaido University in Japan. He taught a number of places. He taught at University of Texas at Austin and also at Princeton before going on to Harvard, and is visiting the campus. And as I mentioned, we'll give a talk later today, 3:30. On the campus. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you can pick up the telephone and give us a call. Just we've talked about this a little bit, but maybe we can do a little bit more on whether looking back at the kind of period that we're talking about, and how it is that people dealt with resource issues, how it is that, now in a time when we're really thinking about that, all over the world we're thinking about that, can you learn some things?
Yes. Well, I think definitely you can see that in the realm of agricultural production, for example, not only did the Japanese use human waste as a fertilizer and returning something that inevitably is produced back to where it can be made good use of, but also all kinds of other organic fertilizers. My first book was a study of a big fishery up in northern Japan in Hokkaido. Mm-hmm. Probably at the time, depending on how one measures such things, it was the biggest herring fishery anywhere in the world. And so millions and millions of herrings were harvested, and some of them were processed into food, but there were too many to eat. And so the herring, too, was processed into a kind of organic fertilizer so that no herring was wasted. And the agricultural productivity of the land increased as a result. I think given that early modern Japan was a resource-poor country, certainly by modern standards, people had to think of ways to make the most out of the materials that they had, whether it was wood or stone or things like fish bones that could then be processed into fertilizer or what have you. And also other things like clothing was worn down and mended, of course, and then recycled. One of the biggest commercial businesses in early modern Japan was the sale and resale of used clothing. And so that things were literally worn until the threads were falling apart, and then they were reprocessed into rags or things like that. And paper, too. People used paper to clean themselves after they used the toilet, and that paper was all recycled paper that had been remade as toilet paper or as tissue from recycled regular paper.
Mm-hmm. Well, just lest people think that this was a perfect reverence for the environment and for use of materials, you also, I'm sure, could tell some stories about really careless use of things, or a sort of a disregard for the same things.
Yes, it is true that although it's tempting to look at Tokugawa Japan as this sort of uniquely green society, in fact, you can see lots of examples of waste of things. For example, in the city of Edo, although human waste was recycled almost universally, other sorts of garbage had a much more mixed record. In ordinary commoner districts, there were elaborate mechanisms where brokers would come and haul away the garbage that people had, whether it's organic, like food waste, or other sorts of things. Some of it was then processed into fertilizer itself. Other stuff was used as landfill. A lot of what's now Tokyo Bay is actually landfill. But on the other hand, in poor districts and then also in the samurai districts, which comprised about half the city, there was no regular mechanism for disposing of waste. And so the samurai, especially in their mansions, were notorious for sort of chucking things over the wall and letting the people on the other side deal with it, or just burying stuff. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the campus of the University of Tokyo is on the site of one of the largest daimyo samurai mansions of the time. It was a whole compound that housed as many as 3,000 people at a time. So there were lots and lots of people living there. And they've dug up these huge garbage pits that were used for decades at a time. And they found all kinds of things, from the bones of dead animals to household things, a lot of ceramics. And among those, they found in the best preserved condition these ceramic bottles that were used to hold sake or soy sauce, vinegar, things of that sort. And the idea of these bottles was that you would take it to the shop, the shopkeeper would fill it, and you'd pay for it, and then you would wash it out and take it back so that it was supposed to be recycled over and over again. But they found literally thousands of these perfectly good, unbroken ceramic bottles discarded. So it looks like the samurai would have a big party, drink a few dozen bottles of sake, and instead of taking it back to the recycling center, they would just throw it out. So there is lots of garbage around, and I think because people weren't thinking in terms of preserving the ecology per se, there were a lot of green results, but maybe not so many green intentions on the part of a lot of people.
And of course, the samurai would have been the wealthiest people, so
yes.
they might not have had to, they might have had the luxury of not having to take the bottles back for the deposit. I suppose they threw out a lot of good stuff, though. I would think that probably people would go and actually scavenge stuff that the samurai would have thrown out because that might have been good, usable, valuable stuff to the person who would pick it up, maybe
yes.
not to the person who had thrown it over the wall.
Yes. I think part of the infrastructure for garbage collection was exactly geared toward finding things that could be used again and maybe selling them and then selling other things for landfill or whatever or other things that could be processed into fertilizer. Mm-hmm. But it's just the wealthy don't care as much and don't need to care as much as poor people.
That's kind of an old story, isn't it?
Yeah.
If I could just ask you something a little bit different. Japan is a nation of islands.
Yes.
And it's quite a long way. I don't know how far, but it's quite from the northernmost part to the southernmost part. It's quite a long
yes.
way. And it's very people. It's diverse. At least it's environmentally, ecologically diverse. I was just interested because you, as I mentioned, you had gone to university in Hokkaido, so the most northernmost island.
Yes.
What's Hokkaido like?
For people in Japan, it's seen as a somewhat exotic tourist destination. I think people from the Midwestern part of the United States wouldn't find it so exotic at all. It's the one place in Japan where, relatively speaking, you have wide open spaces, cornfields, and things of that sort. But it's also true that because it's so far north, there's a lot of snow. The trees are a bit different from a lot of birch trees and things like that that you don't see so much in southern Japan. And because it's the frontier of Japan, there weren't many. Well, the population was very low until the latter part of the 19th century. And especially in the interior, a lot of the agricultural development and other cities and things only date to the late 19th century. It does have a kind of new frontier atmosphere to it. Hmm. It is quite different from the rest of Japan.
Mm. I think. The one thing that I guess I think about Hokkaido is that this is the place where you would find the last vestiges of the people that were thought to be the aboriginal inhabitants of the islands, the Ainu.
Yes. In contemporary Japan, there are about 50,000 people, 30,000 to 50,000 people who actively identify as Ainu out of a population of 140 million, so it's a very small minority. During the Tokugawa period, the Ainu had more or less exclusive rights to inhabit most of the island. And there was a small Japanese community in the southernmost part of the island. And ever since then, the Japanese area of Japanese habitation has expanded and to encompass the entire island. And the Ainu have been, and their culture have been marginalized and to some extent, well, to a great extent, negated, though nowadays there's something of a cultural revival going on.
Mm-hmm. How different are the Ainu from the rest of the Japan?
Yes. Well, nowadays, or historically, the Ainu language is completely different from Japanese. Ainu material culture is quite different. The Ainu were historically people who engaged mostly in hunting and fishing, and then also trade. They were long-distance traders as well. Archaeologists, though, tell us that the ancestors of the Ainu and the ancestors of the majority Japanese population probably all come from the same sort of basic stock, mm-hmm. And that the Japanese, the majority Japanese, look different from the Ainu mostly because of waves of immigration from the continent that occurred in the early part of the common, or the latter part of the BCE and the early part of the common era, but that the Neolithic culture of Japan that was found throughout the islands, the so-called Jomon culture, has, you can trace that to different varieties that eventually connect to Ainu culture.
One of the things that I know that you're interested in is the issue of identity,
yes,
in Japan and how it is that the Japanese think about who they are, what it means to be Japanese, who is Japanese. And I suppose, again, if you ask this question about how what made the rapid modernization, industrialization of the country possible, I'm sure that one thing that people would point to is a fairly high degree of homogeneity in the population. Although I think that you would argue, other people would argue that maybe the way that the Japanese like to think about this doesn't completely square up with the reality.
Yes. I think if you look at the Tokugawa period, you can see that rather than thinking in terms of ethnicity or nationality, things like notions of civilization and barbarism and sorts of customs, especially outward physical appearance, not skin color or facial features, but rather the way one wore one's kimono or the way one dressed one's hair, were markers of whether one was civilized or barbarian. And in that sense, you could argue that being civilized by having these customs that were recognized as civilized customs, in a sense, made one Japanese, that the extent of the authority of the Japanese state was coterminous with the extent of the sort of civilized realm. And I think that helped to situate the Japanese vis-a-vis many of their neighbors elsewhere in East Asia and then eventually with Europeans. And I think also because communications and publishing and things of that sort were so lively, there was also a sense that of Japan as a country, not opposed to other countries, but in distinction from other countries. So there was something of a national identity that was already there. After the Meiji Restoration of 1868 and through the latter part of the 19th century into the 20th century, when Japan started its imperial expansion, eventually colonizing Korea and Taiwan and other places, a kind of discourse that many of the colonial subjects of Japan actually have always been Japanese but haven't known it emerged. So that in the 1920s and 30s, there was a kind of contradictory notion that Japan is ethnically diverse, it's a multicultural empire, yet everybody nonetheless belongs to Japan as subjects of the Japanese emperor. So with Korea is a good example that there were legends that Japan had controlled large parts of the southern part of the Korean peninsula, and that was used as a rationale saying, well, the Koreans were subjects of the emperor, they sort of fell away, now we're bringing them back, so it's a kind of a happy ending. And then after World War II, when the Japanese lost their empire and all that talk of imperial subjects lost its credibility, then you see this notion that the Japanese are uniquely homogeneous and have always been homogeneous emerging. So that there's a kind of funny genealogy there too.
Well, I would expect if for an outsider, somebody like me, for example, if we went and walked around downtown Tokyo or maybe other places in Japan, we'd see a lot of people, and they would probably pretty much look alike, and they pretty much dress alike, and yep. they're all speaking Japanese. And yep. You know, to me, I guess I would think, well, these people are pretty much all alike. But for Japanese themselves, as they look around the people who are walking down the street with them, or they look at their neighbors, or maybe even the way they think about people in some other part of Japan,
mm-hmm.
In their minds, are they still making fine distinctions between people, and are they looking at people and seeing differences?
Not as much as you might think, because people can always find differences if that's what their intention is to do.
Yeah.
I think in some ways, one of the most intriguing features of this issue of identity in modern Japan is how even when no differences could be found, no differences in culture or physiology or language or ancestry could be found, people found a way to make distinctions among some groups of people. And here I'm thinking about the descendants of so-called outcasts in the Tokugawa period, people who stereotypically were leather workers or did other things that brought them into contact with ritual pollution. It's a much more complicated story, but that's the image. These people are absolutely indistinguishable in every respect from their neighbors, yet people in the modern era would go to a great deal of trouble to find out who may or may not have been descended from these outcasts, and to avoid marrying them or employing them. It's surprisingly persistent, so that rather than looking for physical differences where maybe they don't exist, people are finding sort of markers or using ancestry as a marker to find ways to discriminate even when there is no objective way.
This is a very interesting issue. These are the people, burakumin?
The burakumin, yes.
And that means something like village people? Or
yes,
people of the village, and in a sense, it was used to designate people who for what they did for a living, and the people who worked leather were one of them. I suppose butchers and people who dealt with stuff like that was considered to be ritually unclean.
Yes,
those people got lumped into this category, and so pretty much it was a more of a social economic kind of status. It wasn't that you could look at them and see that person was different, but because that's what they did, and they were kind of, I don't know if saying that they're kind of like the untouchable caste in India is sort of the right comparison for people to understand, but it was certainly they were socially outcast.
Yes.
And that continued for how long?
Yes. Well, you can find antecedents even before the Tokugawa period, but as a kind of institutionalized social status, what would eventually become known as Burakumin status emerges in the latter part of the 17th century. In 1871, the new Meiji regime officially abolishes outcast status. And in some ways, discrimination against the Burakumin seems to have increased after the abolition, because previous to that, although there was a lot of discrimination and physical segregation of these people, they also served a vital function within the institutions of the state and had a kind of social importance and political importance and their own internal hierarchies that were recognized by the ruling authorities. Once they lost the support and the kind of place, the institutionalized place in society, then all that was left was discrimination, mm-hmm. in a sense. Mm-hmm.
And today, that still carries some weight with some people. If you, as an individual, you go back, you trace your ancestry back to the Burakumin, that's some people still would not want you to marry their daughter if you were that person.
Yes, it's a bigger problem in the western part of Japan than in the eastern part. Mm-hmm. So, Kyoto, mm-hmm. Osaka, that area, it's a more persistent problem. I think things have gotten a lot better, especially since World War II. But there are people who still care, and the ones who care a lot. about these issues.
We have a couple of minutes left. We do actually have a caller here to bring into the conversation, so why don't we do that? And someone who is in Champaign and on our line number one. Hello.
Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I would be interested to hear your discussion of the Ainu and the viewpoints related to that group of people.
We did, let's talk a little bit. We did talk a little bit about the Ainu, but maybe you can say some more.
Sure. Yeah. During the Tokugawa period, the Japanese authorities went to great lengths to prevent the assimilation of Ainu and Japanese. Mm-hmm. So the Ainu were not supposed to dress in Japanese clothing. They were not supposed to learn the Japanese language. They had lots of trade and labor with Japanese, but they were supposed to be a separate people. After the Meiji Restoration of 1868, the new government did what it could to encourage the Ainu to assimilate into Japanese society. And the guiding idea was the hope that the Ainu would become petty farmers, which is not something that they had done historically. Interestingly, although Japanese authorities in the late 19th and early 20th centuries were aware of the reservation system in North America, and they had American advisors who were encouraging them to create reservations and things of that sort, the Japanese authorities did not do that, and they never thought of the Ainu as a separate nation or people. There were never any treaties or anything of that sort, but rather it was the hope that by giving the Ainu agricultural land and encouraging them to farm and educating them in Japanese, that eventually they would, of their own accord, assimilate. This, of course, did great damage to Ainu culture and was a very traumatic process. But at the same time, it is true that you never see anyone in Japan, in the government at least, making comments like the only good Ainu is a dead Ainu, that kind of thing from the old Westerns. Mm-hmm. That, interestingly, there was not much physical violence against the Ainu, very little. Lots of cultural violence, but not too much physical violence. And I think part of that connects back to the notion that the Ainu have always been Japanese, but they didn't know it. Mm-hmm. According to the Japanese, the Ainu had their own ideas about these things, of course.
We are going to have to stop. We are just at the point here where we're running out of time. For people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, David Howell, he's a professor of Japanese history at Harvard. He'll be talking about this issue we discussed a little earlier in the program about managing human waste in pre-modern Japan this afternoon at 3:30 on the campus in room 223 of Gregory Hall. Open to anybody who'd be interested in stopping by and hearing it. And if you didn't hear that part of the program, you can go back to our website, will.illinois.edu, and hear the rest of the show or other past shows. And thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, David. It's been a great pleasure.